Chapter 2. Formal Matters. Bishop was a lyric poet through and through. She dabbled in other poetic genres, even exploring Ben Jonson's Masques at one point. She wrote and published a number of short stories that have some of the virtues and subjects we find in the poems. One, In the Village, is a recognized masterpiece. She also translated from Portuguese a biographical memoir, The Diary of Helena Morley, which has its loyal readers. And she was one of the supreme letter writers and a teacher of writers' letters as well in the 20th century, a literary practice that spills over into and informs her poetry and has itself been the subject of scholarly and critical treatment. But lyric was her gift and legacy, even while, or rather because, she embraced many of the values associated with prose. This chapter expands on the theme of much in little in Chapter 1 by offering an overview of the various kinds of lyric Bishop wrote: nursery rhymes, songs, ballads, recursive forms such as the villanelle, the sestina, and the sonnet, in conjunction with a few of her more unusual practices with stanzas and lines, and a closing recognition of the importance of the concept of the Baroque in her poetry. The chapter can only be gestural, not comprehensive, by the very nature of Bishop's accomplishment, since the one law she seems to have observed was never to repeat herself. There is no one Bishop poem. This is a chief pleasure of her verse, its unsuspecting originality and high rate of success. Still, a few general points can be ventured. Bishop seems to have conceived each poem as a kind of totality, a little cosmos or world made cunningly, to borrow a phrase from Donne that was much in the air for a poet growing up in the era of T.S. Eliot, whom she interviewed as a college student when he visited Vassar in 1933. And the more impersonal the poem, the better, at least early on, when free verse was but one of many kinds of forms, rather than narrowly predicted, as it came to be seen with Lowell, on a psychological breakdown or personal expression. Each poem was to be a supple, finished object. It possessed its own distinct beginning, middle, and end, not so much marked for all time in the bold manner of, say, Shakespeare's Sonnet 55, not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes, but as written for the specific moment of its reading. Watch it closely. The final line of her anti-monumental, The Monument, might be her motto. No doubt Bishop's often slow rate of composition was a feature of her need to make each poem anew. Her fear of repeating herself, of coming out into the open without new clothing, fed into the sometimes long spells between poems, as she remarked at one point to her psychiatrist, Ruth Foster. Repeat, repeat, repeat was Lowell territory, she noted in North Haven, as was revise, revise, revise. But while Bishop might revise a poem in manuscript, sometimes going to extraordinary lengths, as in the case of the 16 drafts of One Art, her sole villanelle, she rarely repeated a complex form once it appeared in print. On the few occasions that she did, as in the cases of the sonnet and the sestina, the poems appear remarkably different or distant from one another. A Miracle for Breakfast and Sestina are separated in composition by nearly 20 years. The latter represents a slight modification of the form with regard to line length, but small matters are always large in Bishop, even if not all her poems are small. In almost every other way, the two sestinas are diametric opposites in setting, mood, and time of day. A Miracle for Breakfast is a sumptuous, brilliantly lit, visionary feast by a young poet new to the game. I can tell what I saw next. It was not a miracle. A beautiful villa stood in the sun, and from its doors came the smell of hot coffee. In front, a Baroque white plaster balcony, added by birds who nest along the river. I saw it with one eye close to the crumb. Sestina, as we heard in Chapter 1, is a more stringent poem, older, wiser, and much sadder. Sonnets, songs, and ballads. As for sonnets, the few she wrote either are relegated to the edges of her oeuvre, or when they appear in print, do so almost in disguise. Her early college efforts, Three Sonnets for the Eyes, are finished in the formal sense, but they remain among her uncollected poems. And while these are conventional love poems of an Elizabethan kind, the sonnets that do appear in print about love take pains to distort or disrupt the form almost beyond recognition for largely mimetic purposes, as in the case of the third and fourth of Four Poems from A Cold Spring, While Someone Telephones, and O Breath. Or else they are on altogether non-amatory subjects, placed in separate volumes, a pair of sonnets involving a parable on drunkenness in a pigsty in The Prodigal, A Cold Spring, or two sonnets glued together to form a single bleak poem on the Civil War in Washington, D.C., in From Trollope's Journal, Questions of Travel. Both, too, bear Lowell's distinct inflections and mannerisms, his penchant for hyphenated adjectives, glass-smooth dung, followed immediately by light-lashed self-righteous, and harsh realism, with the pentameter line often intensified by alliteration. Their legs were caked the color of dried blood. Even the gorgeous poem that includes North and South, Anaphora, feels more like two poems in the tradition of matins and evensong than a variation on two sonnets that, upon close inspection, they turn out to be. The most cunningly wrought of Bishop's sonnets lies at the far end of her career. Published posthumously in The New Yorker 3 weeks after her death, the simply named sonnet turns the form upside down and much else besides. It is a sliver of a poem, an instance of much and little. It inverts octave and sestet, and like a butterfly or hummingbird, it insists that we watch it closely, so quickly does it go by, flirting with almost every important aspect of Bishop's life: indecision, drunkenness, self-division, imprisonment, movement, mirrors, self-reflection, freedom, and at last, rather surprisingly, the possibility of her lesbian sexuality in the word gay. Caught, the bubble in the spirit level, a creature divided, and the compass needle wobbling and wavering, undecided. Freed, the broken thermometer's mercury running away, and the rainbow bird from the narrow bevel of the empty mirror, flying wherever. It feels like gay. As with sonnets, so with songs, Bishop returns to the genre, but never in quite the same way. Her keen ear for all sorts of music, classical, blues, samba, folk songs, church hymns, brass bands, led her to experiment with a brief suite of Songs for a Colored Singer in North and South, with Billie Holiday in mind, issuing in a host of memorably syncopated rhymes, each poem using a different stanza. For the same volume, she composed Late Air, a belated, or late, reworking of an Elizabethan-style air or song, the kind that elegantly populate the world of the Johnsonian masks. In Questions of Travel, Bishop wrote her own exquisite Song for the Rainy Season in what she called Rumba Rhythm. Six stanzas of 10 short lines apiece lightly alter the pattern of rhymes in each to produce a mesmerizingly fluent revelation of love. In a different key, Brazil, January 1, 1502, conjures up the stern conquering spirit of the Portuguese with L'Homme Armé, or some such tune, a reference to the ancient military hymn associated with a Latin mass. In the Elsewhere section of the same volume, a high vox humana is said somewhere to sing, "The Gray Horse Needs Shoeing," a folk song Bishop seems to have made up as part of the dreamscape of Sunday 4 a.m. More curious and unforgettable still is the lucid scene in At the Fish Houses from A Cold Spring, when Bishop, needing to delay her total immersion into the cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear sea, imagines singing Baptist hymns, plus A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, to to a listening seal, also interested in music. But the musical coup de grace goes to View of the Capitol from the Library of Congress, a funny satire on the Air Force Band and the military more generally. The gathered brasses want to go boom, boom. Some of her own poems, in turn, were set to music by the American composer Elliot Carter in A Mirror on Which to Dwell, 1976, although, rather surprisingly, he included none of her songs. Bishop's supreme valuation of formal variety as a means to singularity was certainly one of the reasons she was drawn to George Herbert, and perhaps a reason why, rather surprisingly, she never quite embraced Emily Dickinson. Herbert was the master of formal invention in English, finding, it seems, a unique expression for each expostulation or ejaculation, whereas Dickinson, however singular in her sensibility and utterance, relied almost exclusively on the common ballad form descending from the bay psalter. Bishop, too, liked the ballad form, with its closed rhyming quatrains, but more for reasons of narrative simplicity and speed than gnomic compression and assertion. One of her most charming early poems is Chemins de Fer in North and South. The title is French for railroad, hinting at the sense of brisk movement associated with the form. But the story that quickly unfolds seems fully American. Indeed, it owes something to her summer camp experiences on Cape Cod, with even a touch of Robert, not Jack, Frost, in the figure of the hermit. It begins, simply enough, "Alone on the railroad track, I walked with pounding heart. The ties were too close together, or maybe too far apart." Love, of course, is the understory here, as it often is in early Bishop. The heart pounds in excitement, but for potentially opposite reasons, as the pun on ties suggests. We soon understand that it is a story about a hermit's unrequited love, of the ties being too far apart. Hoping for an answer from some unnamed other, the hermit fires off his gun in a sign of sexual frustration, while, we're told, the pet hen went chook-chook. The startling ventriloquism is an early instance of Bishop's frequent play with animal sounds in her verse. And, as the solitary hermit is a precursor of the exiled Crusoe in the longer later poem bearing his name, so the comical chook-chook will grow in that later poem into an eccentric mix of goat and gull cries, bah, 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 and shriek, 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 bah, shriek, as both source and sign of Crusoe's suffering on his island of maddening sameness. In the more restrained ballad, the simple chook-chook signifies nature's indifference to the hermit's amatory plight. But we might also hear choke, choke, for the ballad ends with a hapless, throat-clearing shout. "Love should be put into action," screamed the old hermit. Across the pond, an echo tried and tried to confirm it. As one reader notes, the only echo that might possibly return from the old hermit's scream is the ghost rhyme, shun, shun. Unless we hear another from a Frost poem, The Most of It, which is also about failing to receive a counter-response of love. When Bishop returned much later to the ballad form in The Burglar of Babylon, in Questions of Travel, she did so in another country and for a completely different purpose. The roots of Chemins de Fer are essentially literary, perhaps stemming from W.H. Auden's modern revival of the form in the early 20th century. Whereas The Burglar belongs more to the ballad's association with popular writings as represented by Brazil's Literatura de Cordel, Literature on a String, so named because they were produced as booklets, strung up, and sold from kiosks in cities of the Northeast. Bishop owned some of these Cordel poems. Her ballad refurbishes a story that was much in the Rio News about a local outlaw hero, Mikusu, replete with vivid social and political commentary on the plight of the poor in their Babylonian favela, or ghetto, and the nervously dangerous Keystone Cops-like soldiers, not police officers, chasing after their man. Bishop said the ballad practically wrote itself, and one can see why, given the speed and rhythmic ease of the opening stanza. On the fair green hills of Rio, there grows a fearful stain. The poor who come to Rio and can't go home again. And the play with rhyme and point of view. They said he'll go to his auntie, who raised him like a son. She has a little drink shop on the hill of Babylon. And the simple action recounted alongside more complex acts of sympathy and reflection. Rich people in apartments watched through binoculars as long as the daylight lasted, and all night under the stars, Mikusu hid in the grasses or sat in a little tree, listening for sounds and staring at the lighthouse out at sea. Marianne Moore thought The Burglar of Babylon Bishop's best poem, but probably, Bishop was fond of saying, because Moore liked the moral that crime doesn't pay, whereas the ballad offers much more than that. As Lowell intuited, it gives more of Brazil somehow than your whole life book, something recent criticism keeps discovering, especially with regard to Bishop's often conflicted perceptions of the Brazilian people and their culture, drawn to the poor as she was, but from an admittedly superior position in the social hierarchy, an observer defining the observed. As we will hear, though, in part owing to her gender, Bishop saw the world differently, through what Adrienne Rich memorably identified as the eye of the outsider. A bad case of the threes. A Bishop poem Moore did object strongly to was Roosters, one of Bishop's most ambitious, formally insistent, and very best early poems, daringly messy in Tom Gunn's words for this floridly Floridian poem. Bishop plays on this energizing association of word and place, two poems earlier in Florida. Its 44 stanzas are modeled on an unusual form she found in a 17th-century English poem by Richard Crashaw, His Wishes to His Supposed Mistress. Since Roosters possesses a veiled amatory setting of its own, Crashaw's title is not without purpose, but it is the unusual tercets that thrilled Bishop and eventuated in what she called, in a dispute with Moore, a bad case of the threes. Roosters is disposed into rhyming tercets, or threes, in this case, lines of 4, 6, and 10 syllables each. As such, the poem offers an unusual portal into a more politically engaged Bishop than is often the case in her poetry. Published in March 1941, Roosters responds to the outbreak of the Second World War by presenting a barnyard fable of sorts stemming from the early morning cry of a single rooster into multiple cries galore all about town. The poem offers a gendered critique of masculine warmongering in the first half, answered in the second half on a quieter note with an elaborate account of the cock's religious iconography, constructed around Peter's threefold denial of Christ, Matthew chapter 26, verse 24. Bishop rarely lets her learning show as much as she does in the second half of the poem. Connecting the two parts is an amorous thread drawn from the Obad tradition involving two lovers waking in the morning, a favorite subject of Bishop's, in this case, one that echoes Donne's The Sun Rising. The amatory theme will continue through the reference to Mary Magdalene, whose sin was of the flesh alone, whereas Peter's was of the spirit. It will then be touched on again at the end of the poem. Amid the gorgeous imagery of the sunlight gilding the tiny, floating swallow's belly and lines of pink cloud in the sky, there is a whisper of concern that perhaps all has not gone perfectly with the lovers during the night. Some readers have felt that the sexually private displaces the war as political subject, but the poem's allegorical mode doesn't allow for easily containing the effects of battle. Bishop's domesticated roosters can be rendered with all the violence of fighter pilots. Now, in midair, by twos, they fight each other. Down comes a first flame feather, and one is flying with raging heroism, defying even the sensation of dying. And one has fallen, but still, above the town, his torn out, bloodied feathers drift down. And what he sung no matter. He has flown on the gray ash heap, lies in dung, with his dead wives and open bloody eyes, while those metallic feathers oxidize. So much for the glories of aerial combat. What he sung, no matter. Time to turn in another direction, as Bishop does, toward old holy scripture for a story of hope. Among the poem's many sordidities that the fastidious Moore sought to expunge, including Bishop's reference to a water closet, the older poet undertook to rewrite a cleaner version of the poem without the offending tercets and sent it to Bishop. Bishop made a few concessions to her mentor's criticisms. She changed the first word of each line into the lower case, for instance, but remarked, diplomatically, that, "I can't seem to bring myself to give up the set form." The form, with its expanding lines and rattle-trap rhythm, was crucial to the poem's violence of tone, what we might call Rooster's intrusive subject matter in both the public and private sphere, so different from the element of colloquial immediacy, of readerly intimacy, that often characterizes her verse. Although Bishop never says as much, she must have had in mind the actual sound of the rooster cry. It is often three sharply punctuated expanding cries, a matter of duration reflected in the expanding lines, rather than the way the sound is typically represented in print as a single sharp cry with three stresses, cock-a-doodle-doo. The immediate rustic setting for roosters was inspired by Bishop's time in Key West, Florida, an important period in her growth as a poet, but it's also difficult to think that her ear was not already tuned to the chook-chook of chickens and the cries galore of roosters from her early days in rural Nova Scotia. The shush-shush-shush sound of cattle and people walking on wet sand in Santa Ram is one of the many ways Bishop enlivens her verse by bringing it down to earth, in much the same way that her parentheses turn the formal into the informal and strike a note of immediacy or spontaneity. The most famous example here is probably the parenthetical aside in One Art, when Bishop further infuses the villanelle, a form that thrives on repetition, with immediacy, dashed off, literally, in the spontaneous manner of an afterthought. "Even losing you," the joking voice, a gesture I love. Through typography, she encases or cradles a verbal gesture that she loves, what we think of here as intimate speech, now set off for both the speaker and reader to cherish. So, too, she reveled in generically lower or more popular forms of literature, such as the ballad, nursery rhyme, parable, or beast fable. Making it new is not simply reenacting a high modernist credo made famous by Ezra Pound, who is himself the subject of an extended remaking of a nursery rhyme in Visits to St. Elizabeth's and the grim shadows the form often contains. The poem is based on "This is the house that Jack built." We should also notice her funny comment to Moore, how a bovine Wallace Stevens, for all his tightrope walk with ideas, occasionally seems to make blank verse moo. Humor, as well as childhood memories, helped the young bishop to imagine entering the largely modernist male fold, as does giving an occasional rap on the knuckles. While a student at Vassar, she writes to Donald Stanford, a graduate student in English at Harvard, "And one thing more. What on earth do you mean when you say my perceptions are almost impossible for a woman's? Now what the hell, as you said to me, you know that's meaningless." Stretching the line. Roosters turns Crashaw's airy ideas to his supposed mistress, earthward. The poem also occupies a pivotal moment in Bishop's relationship with Moore. It marked out her greater independence from the mentor whom she much admired. But their friendship continued, although now on more even ground. Moore actively championed the publication of Bishop's first book of poems, North and South, by Houghton Mifflin, 1946, and Bishop returned the favor in her elaborate poem, An Invitation to Miss Marianne Moore, in The Quarterly Review of Literature, 1948, reprinted near the end of A Cold Spring, 1955, and, in the same issue, the illuminating essay to be discussed in Chapter 3, As We Like It, Miss Moore and the Delight of Imitation. Moore was also the subject of several other tributes written for college publications, Bryn Mawr, 1962, and Harvard, 1974. Bishop's affection for tercets continued too, but always with subtle differences, as we've come to expect. Waiting at Wellfleet, Little Exercise, Under the Window, Oro Preto, and Pink Dog are different not only from the more formally startling roosters, but from each other as well. Bishop clearly liked the tercet's terseness, its concentrated phrasing, in the service of Dog Trot's pentameter in Pink Dog, which is even more evident in her occasional use of the Demeter line. Half is enough, she wittily concludes The Gentleman of Shalott, an early poem written in Demeter. A later instance is Night City, again in a different format. But she was not wedded to the idea of small forms, of being caught, as early, abundantly descriptive poems like Florida and The Bite remind us. Much of the sought-after variety, the originality of her poetry, comes from how, throughout her career, Bishop stretched the line across and down the page. Widely across, as in the case of The Man Moth, in which the long-line stanzas contribute visually to the alienation effect of the urbanized human subject, fit for a Kafka novel, a practice of poetic defamiliarization that is further extended into the prose of 12 O'Clock News, and narrowly down the page, again, both early and late, in Geronimo's House and The Moose. The single opening sentence of the latter poem, with its traveling bus and passengers, meanders mimetically through the Nova Scotian countryside for six stanzas until arriving at its first full stop in line 36. Although Bishop's literary models are many, her freedom with the extended short line, often playing sense against syntax, is reminiscent of William Carlos Williams's experiments with free verse, as in his deliberately slight This Is Just to Say, but worked out in the case of Geronimo's House in a more whimsically airy, domestic front, as the precarious placement of fairy and perishable suggest. My house, my fairy palace, is of perishable clapboards, with three rooms in all, my gray wasp's nest of chewed-up paper, glued with spit. No need to tell her, a la Moore, not to capitalize the left-hand margin. Bishop doesn't want anything as intrusive as roosters to interfere with the delicate effects of this loose grouping of decorations, of ephemera strung together into an intimate portrait of a domestic interior, nor anything as off-putting as the block-like stanzas of Man Moth. Bishop's poem is an open invitation for the reader to enter into the creative life of the house and its rooms, its stanzas. Come closer. You can see and hear the writing paper, lines of light, and the voices of my radio. Vertically slim lines of light could be expanded and packaged into quatrains of simple, ballad-like construction. Manners, Large Bad Picture, A Summer's Dream, Letter to New York, Sunday, 4 a.m., The Armadillo, each time slightly changing the line length or rhyme scheme, or into the more sophisticated measure of Twelfth Morning or What You Will, with each quatrain concluding in the matter of a sapphic with a short line, or into the obsessively detailed longer lines of the frantic sandpiper, and then opened up and expanded further, capaciously and freely, to give a sense of overflowing amplitude. Here is the beginning of Questions of Travel, responding to the overwhelming profusion of the Brazilian landscape as a visitor experiencing vertigo might first see it. There are too many waterfalls here. The crowded streams hurry too rapidly down to the sea, and the pressure of so many clouds on the mountaintops makes them spill over the sides in soft, slow motion, turning to waterfalls under our very eyes. For if those streaks, those mile-long, shiny tear stains, aren't waterfalls yet, In a quick age or so, as ages go here, they probably will be. But if the streams and clouds keep traveling, traveling, the mountains look like hulls of capsized ships, slime-hung and barnacled. This may be Bishop at her most baroque, an adjective with a complex literary history that, in her case, can be traced back to a formative moment as a college student when she came across an important scholarly essay by Morris Kroll, The Baroque Style in Prose, 1929, during a time when she was seeking to discover her voice. In its self-conscious modernism, the Baroque style for Kroll was the antithesis of the classical. Rather than favoring symmetry and balance of the Ciceronian order, neither a borrower nor a lender be, it valued the asymmetrical and spontaneous. Notice the great variance in her line length, with Seneca as the model, and the prose of John Donne and Sir Thomas Browne as chief examples. Parataxis, rather than hypotaxis, abounds, a preference for adjacent phrases over subordinate clauses. Everything only connected by and, as she noted at the end of over 2,000 illustrations and a complete concordance. Not a thought, but a mind thinking. A single statement might set the theme as before. There are too many waterfalls here. It could then be amplified according to the pressure of thought, with the crowded streams already overriding the first line in their hurry, and continuing in the subsequent lines of uneven length to arrive at an eventual period or stop, only to have a dash pick up the idea in midstream, as it were, and begin another venture, turning thought back on itself. It is a heady reflective move. Kroll gave the style a memorable formation that struck a chord with Bishop, which she copied out, along with other ideas from Kroll and Hopkins, in the letter to Donald Stanford already cited. Their purpose, the writers of Baroque prose, was to portray not a thought, but a mind thinking. They knew that an idea separated from the act of experiencing it is not the idea that was experienced. The ardor of its conception in the mind is a necessary part of the truth. Bishop was especially drawn to Kroll, she tells us, because of her discomfort with feeling bound by traditional meter. I can write in iambics if I want to, but just now I don't know my own mind quite well enough to say what I want to in them. If I try to write smoothly, I find myself perverting the meaning for the sake of the smoothness. Many years later, Kroll's emphasis on portraying the mind thinking was still with her, even if his name was not within easy reach. But she certainly knew her own mind with regard to prosody. In the previous passage, Bishop tacks to and from the pentameter line with great freedom, subordinating iambic feet to dactylic meter in the 10-syllable line. Hurry to, rapidly, down to the sea. Then, stretching that line to a maximum of 14 syllables to set forth the pressure of so many clouds on the mountaintops. Then she returns, but with a difference. There's always a difference with Bishop, to the running dactyls of turning to waterfalls under our very eyes by adding two syllables, in this case iambic. Finally, she radically curtails the line for a maximum sonic effect of closure by employing a spondee followed by two iambic feet. Slime-hung and barnacled pulls the whole passage with its cloud-like fleeting sense of the dactylic traveling, down to earth with an Anglo-Saxon thump, and registering with it a sense of mortality in the image of the mountains as capsized ships. Here is not a description per se, but the act of experiencing in the mind what the eye sees. Kroll's formulation points in two important but related directions in Bishop. By being drawn from prose, it helps to underscore Bishop's revolutionary place as the first poet successfully to use all the resources of prose. Readers usually have in mind here a variety of effects that contribute to making her verse sound natural. Casually deployed phrases. Well, I had 52, miserable small volcanoes I could climb. Errant thinking, a light to read by, perfect, but impossible, when custom has led us to believe that thought and poetry should be more finished, parenthetical asides or dashes, as we've already noticed, descriptions of the simple factual kind often associated with prose. I caught a fish. Here is a coast. Here is a harbor. Lists of many sorts, and a penchant for plain, unvarnished diction, as if she is taking the paint off words with each repetition. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight. The revolutionary aspects also include not just noting local stylistic markers like those that we associate with prose, but recognizing and responding to prose's broader rhythms that purposefully knit long stretches of her verse together. The repetition of like sounds in the passage, streams, sea, streaks, be, keep, with a return to streams, for instance. The calculated shift in line length to lend a variable movement to the whole. Think of the long phrase accentuated in the shift from the short to long O's of soft, slow motion. The echoing repetition of key words like traveling, traveling, in a poem bearing the title of Questions of Travel, in which questions and quest are intimately linked. Lyricism seems to persist quite deliciously, right along with the extended list of questions. Oh, must we dream our dreams and have them too? And have we room for one more folded sunset, still quite warm? Sunsets are the stuff of poetry. Folded sunsets are what we pack in suitcases. In this case, however, in a near-perfect iambic pentameter line that concludes with three rising stresses. Kroll's remarks also help to differentiate Bishop from Moore, who conceived of a poem as an elaborately constructed, finished artifact, a type of stylized collage, by pointing toward an essential truth of Bishop's own poetry, gradually and variously worked out over her career, and in keeping with the more experiential aspects of American poetry, how to represent the ardor of conception, the mind thinking, and, as a consequence, the poem as a place to embrace the larger rhythms of change and open-endedness, of exploration and process. What were stylistically important were not the cumulative effects of symmetry and smoothness, but the turns of thought associated with irregularities, with shifting gears, as she said much later in The Moose, with thoughts going forward by often backtracking, turning in and against themselves, opening up spaces and gaps in the thinking, as she does with increasing freedom in her later verse, by frequently employing a device known as metanoia, or self-correction. It is one of her most indelible and attractive features, at once a sign of her modesty and her desire to be truthful to experience. To some degree, Wallace Stevens set the table for his modernist contemporaries when he wrote in Of Modern Poetry, "The poem of the mind in the act of finding what will suffice. It has not always had to find. The scene was set. It repeated what was in the script." There is a great deal of Stevens in Bishop. Harmonium was a book she said she had almost by heart. She elsewhere spoke of admiring the display of ideas at work in his poetry. And there are lines in her poetry that, without the example of Stevens, seem unthinkable in their majestic play with perception. This celestial seascape, with white herons got up as angels, flying as high as they want and as far as they want, sideways, in tiers and tiers of immaculate reflections. Seascape. But, if accuracy of observation is equivalent to accuracy of thinking, as Stevens himself observed in Adagia, it is Bishop, not Stevens, who best fulfilled the modernist ideal of poetry as the act of finding on a human scale in a world of familiar and not so familiar objects. Hers is the new script of a world felt not just in the imagination, but with the eyes and fingers, a script that anticipates the improvisational and irresolute, the undoing of certainty so prized by postmodernist poets like John Ashbery, in poems that seem as grammatically fixed and meditated as any in the language.